From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and we want to respond now to breaking news. President Trump tweeting out, "I informed John Bolton last night that his services are no longer needed at the White House. I disagreed strongly with many of his suggestions, as did others in the administration. And therefore, I asked John for his resignation, which was given to me this morning. I thank John very much for his service. I'll be naming a new national security advisor next week." Let's bring in Beth Fooey, senior politics editor for NBC News. Beth, most recently, there were reports that John Bolton disagreed with President Trump's idea of having the Taliban come to Camp David so that the president could have the optics of negotiating a peace agreement, one that had already been signed in principle between the Taliban and the State Department negotiator. So there was a huge disagreement apparently in that room between the State Department, Mike Pompeo, and John Bolton over what the president should do. Your sense of this response, it seems, a couple days later.
Yeah, I mean, our White House team is still reporting this out to find out exactly what went down and what is behind this sudden firing. We know that John Bolton and other members of the team were supposed to brief reporters at 1:30 today in the White House. So obviously this is coming very suddenly, and our team is still working on finding out exactly what went down. But as you said, Robin, we do know from reporting of several news organizations, including NBC News, that there was a disagreement between Bolton and Secretary of State Mike Pompeo about these peace negotiations with the Taliban. President Trump has mentioned how he finds Bolton in the past to be, you know, quite a, you know, he's aggressive, wanted to perhaps move a little bit in a different direction from the president on a number of national security challenges. But why he chose this particular moment to ask him for his resignation, we're still working on.
Well, it's been reported in the past that Bolton was, for instance, appalled by the diplomatic track with North Korea. He angered the North Koreans, was later undercut by Trump when he referred to a Libya model. Libya gave up its nuclear weapons and its leader was overthrown. He's also been sidelined. I mean, in these discussions about Afghanistan, John Bolton was beamed in from Warsaw.
Yeah, it definitely has sounded as though he's been on the outs with President Trump for a while. But let's keep in mind, President Trump has a sort of a pattern of bringing people on with great fanfare and then losing confidence in them. I mean, we saw that we've seen that with a number of members of his administration thus far. So it's a bit surprising that this would happen so out of the blue. But we have gotten the sense over time that John Bolton has been on the outs with President Trump.
I just want to get a quick reaction from our other guest who's in the studio with us now, Julian Zelizer, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. Julian, what do you make of this, just the latest firing from somebody on the high levels of President Trump's national security team?
Well, in terms of policy, there's always been a tension between the two of them. President Trump has been someone who has at least campaigned and promised to, you know, keep America out of as much intervention as possible, while Bolton is one of the neoconservatives from the George W. Bush era.
But didn't he know that's what he was getting when he hired Bolton?
No, absolutely. And the contradiction's not a secret. It's been there from the start. And when Bolton was brought on, there were questions right away of how does he manage this. Trump, I think, was said to have joked, if it was up to John, we'd be in four wars now. And so there's also a personality difference, and that's been reported on, that Trump really didn't like him and he didn't like how abrasive and confrontational he can be. And so that matters with President Trump. So both of these are at work, and the surprise, you know, is that it unfolds, as always, through a tweet.
Well, that's not a surprise, right, at this point. But, Julian, a quick question. We're going to go back to Beth Fooey. There's other news and politics today that we want to get to. But it would seem that with his banishment, which has been going on for a while, the effect of that would be, I mean, your national security advisor is supposed to be your glove. And the effect of that would be that world leaders, other countries would then have to go, would be going. They can see he's been sidelined. They would go directly to President Trump.
Oh, absolutely. And President Trump has shed many advisors who other countries or other leaders would naturally have some confidence speaking to. This is one more falling away. And so it in effect, centralizes power in the president, which is something that he likes. In the end, President Trump likes to make his own decisions. I'm sure he's frustrated with what happened with the, you know, proposed Camp David meeting and the fallout over that. And so the more people he knocks away, he's fine with that. He is not a president who depends or values expertise.
Well, we want to talk more about Camp David. That's why you were here originally, and we're going to do that. But Beth Pooy, NBC, I want to go back to you because there's other news today, and this has to do with the other thing percolating, which is Sharpiegate. And
the, one of the other things percolating.
Right, one of the many. The acting administrator for the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, this is Dr. Neil Jacobs, addressed this today. And this is, of course, the storm over the president's false claim that Alabama was in the line of Hurricane Dorian. And someone's inept attempt to prove that with a Sharpie outline on a weather map. There had been reports that Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross, and again, NOAA is in the Commerce Department, that Secretary Ross threatened to fire the local NOAA officials who'd contradicted the president when he said this. And after they did that, NOAA itself, the agency, issued a statement supporting the president. Well, today Jacob said no one's job is under threat. And he also addressed widespread criticism over the thought that the agency statement was supporting the president.
The purpose of the NOAA statement was to clarify the technical aspects of the potential impacts of Dorian. What it did not say, however, is that we understand and fully support the good intent of the Birmingham Weather Forecast Office, which was to calm fears in support of public safety.
And Beth, we should note that Dr. Jacobs was speaking at this meeting this week of some very angry members of the National Weather Association in, fittingly, Huntsville, Alabama, who are feeling attacked by the president. How important politically is this?
Well, so another thing that he was reported to have said is the weather should never be politicized, which I think everybody can agree on that. Look, we are still trying to sort through the role that Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross had in this. It's been reported that he threatened folks at NOAA with their jobs if they didn't back up the president. We do not have that reporting independently, and Wilbur Ross is denying that that happened. His office is denying that that ever happened. So we are still trying to untangle exactly what went down there. But it's very consistent with President Trump that he doesn't want to be made to look as though he made a mistake. And he has decided that he is going to just stay on this and continue to talk about it until he can feel like on some level he's prevailed. This is pretty consistent with what we've seen in the past. We haven't seen it in the past with him on weather. Yeah. But he, you know, at some point along the way, he apparently felt that in a briefing that he was given about Hurricane Dorian, that there was a chance that Alabama could be hit, which is what he tweeted. He could have come back and said later, happy to know that Alabama isn't in the line of sight of the storm as perhaps was indicated very early on, but he chose not to do that and to sort of create a narrative that it's him versus the media on who's right. And we've seen him really escalating his attacks on the press and the media in the last week or two, even at a higher level than we've seen in the past.
Well, I think we want to go back and talk about the news of the day, which is that the other news of the day, which is that John Bolton has been fired. And John Bolton had a connection to Camp David.
Well, and Julian Zelizer, we brought you here originally to talk about Camp David, and we now have, of course, history gets the short shrift now. We've only got a couple minutes left. But I do want to ask you about the fact that President Trump had said a lot of bad people had come through Camp David when he was under pressure because he had invited the Taliban in the first place to come to Camp David. What are the bad people that have come to Camp David?
Well, one example people might point to is Putin, who was there in 2003 to meet with George W. Bush as they tried to work out issues between Russia and the United States unsuccessfully. So maybe that's who President Trump had on his mind. I doubt it. But maybe that's one person. There's been other Soviet leaders there. Brezhnev was there in 1973 to meet with Nixon. But usually why we remember Camp David, it's a site of diplomacy. And the most famous example is 1970. 1978 when Carter met with Menachem Begin of Israel and Sadat of Egypt and worked out a historic breakthrough accord between the two nations, literally using his presidential muscle to go between the two of them. And so that's why I think some people are uneasy with President Trump trying to use this and doing it in a very odd way.
Well, do you think that President Trump had that moment in his mind when he thought about doing this in the first place, that he wanted to be essentially the Carter that was able to broker a peace deal at Camp David?
Maybe. I can't read President Trump's mind. But he hasn't used Camp David that much. He's been much more happier going to his properties. So it is unusual that this is where he decided to take this step. So perhaps he's looking for ways to look presidential, to create some kind of legacy. And he was around in that Carter moment and might be part of his imprint.
That is Julian Zelizer, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. And we've also been speaking with Beth Fooey of NBC News as we look back at the history and also follow today's news that John Bolton, the U.S. National Security Advisor, has been fired by President Trump. Mm-hmm. Thanks to both of you.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Have you heard of or worn Allbirds? They're shoes from a San Francisco-based company that has grown from a 2014 Kickstarter campaign into a billion-dollar brand in just 5 years. The shoes are made from renewable materials like wool, eucalyptus fiber, and sugarcane. Co-founder and CEO Tim Brown joins me now as part of our series of conversations with leaders called View from the Top. Welcome.
Thanks for having us.
Absolutely. It's great to have you. And before you started Allbirds, you were a professional soccer player. You went to the 2010 FIFA World Cup as New Zealand's vice captain. And then you co-founded Allbirds following a Kickstarter project back in 2014. How did you come up with the idea?
Yeah, I was playing football for a living, or soccer, in the Australian A-League. And one of the great benefits of playing professional sport was you got lots of free gear. And the original kernel of the idea that was to become Allbirds was really a reaction to heavily logoed sportswear and apparel that I had to wear all the time as part of my job. And I started chipping away at what really could only be described as a curiosity project probably back in 2007.
And what were you looking for?
I was looking, at least initially, for a really simple sneaker, and the design challenge was, if you were going to make one pair of sneakers, what would it look like? And I set out to do that. In one of my off seasons, visited my first footwear factory and found an industry that's incredibly old-fashioned in the way that it makes product. The way shoes are made hasn't really changed in decades, and tends to default to making products out of not very nice synthetics. And so saw an opportunity to innovate with materials on top of that design thesis, and then set about making some shoes that I sold to my teammates initially.
But what you were looking for was simplicity.
Simplicity, and what I discovered was an opportunity with materials, and then ultimately a different type of business model. And Allbirds now is direct-to-consumer, so we sell shoes only through our own channels. We now have 11 retail stores globally and our own website, but we avoided wholesale, which is traditionally where most of footwear goes, and that allowed us the margin room to invest in materials that were better for the environment. So it became the real opportunity we saw, is to sort of merge this idea of materials that were better for the environment with a different type of business model that made it possible.
Well, let's talk about that, the materials. You published the formula for the sugarcane-based sweet foam in your shoes. Tell us what's different about your shoes than the other sneakers that are out there on the market.
Yeah, EVA is one of the most commonly used materials in footwear. It's on the bottom of every pair of sneakers that you could imagine, and it's made from petroleum-derived products. And we found a way to take the petrol out and swap it with sugarcane, and the byproduct of the production of ethanol, which is actually, it works out carbon negative in its raw form. And it was an innovation we brought to market last year, and something that we made open source to the entire footwear industry to use, which, you know, for a traditionally the footwear space is about secrecy and keeping things to yourself. But our purpose and our mission is around, you know, tackling this climate crisis with products that are made more sustainably. And so that necessitates sort of a different approach.
What about the cost of doing that? Because that's often the reason that companies don't opt for the more environmentally sustainable option.
Yeah, it is more expensive, but we're able to invest in that through a direct business model. So there's no wholesale in between, which gives us the margin room to pay up for these materials. And part of the thinking with sharing it is that not only does that get it out to more people and have, it also reduces the cost as more people adopt it. So, I mean, I think oftentimes the conversation around sustainability is one of emotion, where actually, we sort of think it's best tackled as a rational economic discussion, and ways are found to kind of do both, do things that are better for the business and better for the environment at the same time.
Now, the other thing that people say about Allbirds is that they're comfortable. They're like walking on a cloud. Don't you actually have a tagline that says something about a cloud?
Yeah. So it was one of the things we discovered along the way, that comfort is the number one reason why people buy shoes, and it's often equated with ugly.
Right. You don't want to be wearing comfortable shoes because they're not going to be
exactly right. Yeah. But the idea that the materials that we were exploring, the natural, sustainable materials, actually also made a better comfort experience was a real unlock on the journey to kind of build the business, because people don't buy sustainable products, they buy great ones. So we, on the 1st of March 2016, Allbirds was born after nearly 7 or 8 years of experiments, and we sold one shoe made of New Zealand merino wool, and they were really comfortable, and it kind of just caught on.
How did you get so big so quick? You just said 2016. It's kind of amazing, because now you see people wearing Allbirds all over the place. How did you get so big so fast?
Yeah, I mean, in some ways we were as surprised as anyone. We started the business, Joey and I, my co-founder, here in San Francisco. Our wives were best friends at university, and we came together to build the business, and he helped capture the early experiments and shape it into, the business that it is today. And we launched with him and I think 3 or 4 other people working out of his mother-in-law's house in San Rafael, and it just kind of took off. And in the first week, Time magazine called the shoes the most comfortable in the world, which is a good moment, and it's just gone from there. And now the team is nearly 350 people, with offices in China and a team on the ground in the UK, and still selling a very small amount of products relatively. But I think we've been blown away by the reception to it.
How much did social media, and in particular Instagram, have to do with your growth? Because a lot of people who ended up buying Allbirds found them because they showed up in their ads on Instagram.
I think it was a relatively small part. I mean, this was driven by word of mouth and people telling other people about a product that did something differently than all the rest, and maybe stood for something that the others didn't. And that's, we could never have paid for the type of growth that we've had. This has been something that we imagined and planned for, certainly, but has been fueled by people sharing this within their own networks. This is not a narrow San Francisco or a New York story. It's much broader than that, and it's all ages, all demographics, all different walks of life, and that's not usually how you write a business plan. And so this idea that that one of the most surprising things has been the universal idea of simple design and comfort and this larger purpose of sustainability is appealed to a lot of different people.
It has appealed to a lot of different people, but it did start with the popularity among tech workers, right? That people in your area around San Francisco were early adopters of Allbirds.
Yeah, they were one part of it. And there was this community of people that, for whatever reason, it became part of their uniform and still is. And that's been great to see. Our biggest market has been New York. From the outset, and remains so.
A lot of walking in New York.
A lot of walking, yeah. It's kind of this thing's taken on a life of its own, in an amazing special way.
Do you consider Allbirds a tech company?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I think we're a material innovation company. I think sometimes when you're forced to sort of kind of wrap something up in such a succinct way, it sounds a little manufactured. But at the end of the day, the thing that we're trying to do is use materials that haven't really been used in footwear before in different sorts of ways. And we started with wool, and we've added another upper material made out of eucalyptus fiber, and added a sole material, as we talked about, made from sugarcane. And that's the exciting bit. And obviously there's an enormous sort of design and style component to it all too, but that's the thing that I think that we're doing that no one else really is doing in our space,
And you make the shoes in Italy, right?
The wool is knitted for us in Italy, mm-hmm. Which is New Zealand merino, and the eucalyptus fiber comes from South Africa. The sugar came from Brazil. So it's very, very much, very, very quickly a global supply chain that's actually very, very complicated and difficult to do.
Why not just make everything in the United States?
Oh, I just think that that's it's probably a little naive and impossible to do. It depends on your category, obviously, but in the case of footwear, we couldn't be making the product that we wanted. Initially, I tried to, you know, to do that in New Zealand when this thing first started, and it was impossible. And I would like to say probably for now, as things stand, impossible in the States too, which is to say prohibitively expensive without the infrastructure and the knowledge base to actually do that. Over time, that may change, but at the moment, we've kind of gone to the best places in the world to find the best materials and focused deeply on the idea of sea shipping to connect the dots on that to limit the impact, and that's mm-hmm. been our approach.
Has the trade war affected you at all?
Yeah, it has, and that's a day-to-day thing and not ideal. But look, there's lots of other people in that boat too.
What shoes did you wear when you were growing up?
You know, in New Zealand, it was really, really hard to kind of find simple. There was this really small old brand that some people will remember. It's more of a European story called Barter Bullets, which were like a very, very old, really simple trainer. And there was Chuck Taylors and not too much else in terms of simplicity. And then I started playing sport and I wore everything with a giant logo on it. So now that we've started Allbirds, what people don't tell you about starting a footwear brand is you've got to wear your shoes every single day. So it's a better incentive, better incentive than anything to make a product that you like.
I want to just ask you one more question just out of curiosity. Is there any international market that's been particularly surprising to you or difficult to break into, or they've taken to the shoes faster than you thought they would or anything like that?
Oh, it's difficult not to give a shout out to New Zealand. I mean, that's where the idea was born, and we launched the shoes initially online in America and New Zealand only, which was kind of complicated for us out of the gate. But it was important that mum could buy a pair and that we rewarded where this thing had sort of come from. And the reception, the reaction there has been incredible. And I like to sort of say I knew we were on the right track when we got a new Prime Minister, Jacinda Ardern. She's mm-hmm. 37, and she.
I think the whole world knows her now because of the shooting there. Yeah.
She's doing a great job, and she met the Australian Prime Minister for the first time and gifted him a pair of Allbirds. And mum rang me and said, "You've made it." And so, the reaction to New Zealand has been great. And we just opened our first retail store down there in Auckland, which was special and had an amazing reaction too. So that's a good story, long may that continue.
That is Tim Brown, the co-founder and co-CEO of Allbirds. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Great to chat.
The gig could soon be up in California for companies like Uber and Lyft. State senators are about to pass a bill that would reclassify 2 million gig workers as employees rather than independent contractors. Governor Gavin Newsom says he supports the bill, known as AB5, which means he'll sign it. And that means manicurists, exotic dancers, Uber and Lyft drivers would receive employee benefits, minimum wage, overtime, workers' compensation, the right to unionize. Companies like Uber oppose it. They say they can't afford it. There will be layoffs and less flexible hours. Let's bring in Mike Regan, senior editor at Bloomberg News. Mike, we know AB5 follows up an earlier Supreme Court case decision in California that said you can only classify someone as an independent contractor if the work they perform is outside the company's core business. Of course, in the case of Uber and Lyft, you know, the driving is the core business. They can't claim that. So what happens? Are all Uber and Lyft drivers suddenly employees?
Well, Robin, it's doubtful that all the California drivers would become employees overnight. The companies are very likely to challenge this in the courts. And ultimately, what Uber is hoping is for a sort of compromise where they begin offering some perks to drivers like guaranteed earnings per hour, compensation for expenses, and access to benefits. But they still want to classify them as independent contractors rather than employees. So it's bound to take a while, I think, for the courts to sort of sort this out, how Uber and Lyft will fit into this law.
Well, one driver said, it was quoted saying, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to realize that if drivers are guaranteed a minimum wage, which employees get. They can't just flip the app on anywhere from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. because there are going to be way too many drivers and not enough rides. So that's, you know, they're already worried that this, there's just no way that Uber can pay them the minimum wage. But other drivers feel they can. Talk about the debate over this.
Yeah, you know, I think it's a case-by-case situation depending on the driver you're talking about. I mean, certainly there are some drivers, and I imagine Uber and Lyft would argue that it's many, if not most, of the drivers who actually prefer the flexibility that comes with the current setup. You know, they turn on the app when they want to drive, and they don't have to work when they don't want to or have to, or if they have a schedule conflict, and they – you know, like this arrangement because they're not beholden to a schedule. But certainly there are some drivers who I'm sure would prefer being classified as employees and the protections and benefits that, that come with it. You know, it'd be interesting if they could get to a compromise where they offer the drivers the choice, you know, to be a full-time employee.
Who chooses, But what about what this will do to Uber and the bottom line of companies like Uber, Lyft? And I'm thinking of the food shopping and delivery companies that rely on these gig workers. What do you think it'll do to them?
Well, you know, and it's important to remember when you talk about the bottom line of these companies, neither Uber or Lyft is a profitable company yet. I mean, they do have public stocks on the stock market, but they're not profitable. And I think the way they're pushing back against this law with such an effort to prevent it, I think tells you all you need to know about how damaging they view it could be to their potential profits down the road.
Well, we will watch as it unfolds. Mike Regan, senior editor at Bloomberg News, thank you so much.
Thanks, Robin.
And it's college application season. Students often writing one essay that they use for the common application, which most private colleges and universities accept. But some students may be surprised to find out there are also supplemental questions. Our next guest describes these as little vignettes or snapshots that individual schools might ask students to write. Some ask for just one, but Wake Forest University in North Carolina asks for six. Again, these are shorter snapshots, kind of the Twitter of the college essay. Some of the topics we're hearing about, it's 2040, what's the newspaper headline? Or if you ran a food truck, what would it be named and what would you serve? Well, joining us with advice on how to answer these supplemental questions is Stephen Farmer, Vice Provost for Enrollment and Undergraduate Admissions at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Hi, Steve.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
So is this familiar to you, a food truck question?
The food truck question's new to me, but short supplemental questions aren't new to me. We've been asking them for a while.
And why?
We like to have a variety of samples of students writing, and we also like to give students several chances to help us get to know them.
Yeah, so what are some other questions that you are asking?
This year we're asking students to tell us about a peer who's made a difference in their life. Mm-hmm. We're asking them to tell us what they hope will change about the place where they live. We have a couple of other options for them. What's one thing we don't know about them that they want us to know? Or what about their background or experience or perspective will help them contribute to the education of others at UNC?
And what's the word limit?
About 250 words.
Okay, so these are shorter than, you know, the 600-word or higher essays, the longer essays that they have to do. I mean, you say you're going to get to know them better. If a school really does, you know, six maybe, you even do two per student, do you really read them all?
We really do read them all.
Yeah. Really?
And read them more than once. You know, they really are a good chance to get to know students. They're not the only way that we know them. Students have others write on their behalf. They have academic records. We actually know a fair amount about students, but we really want to give students a chance to let us hear their voices and to hear their voices in an unmediated way.
Well, when you say students have someone else write on their behalf, that immediately makes us think about the fact that students often have someone else write them, period. I mean, you're talking about someone writing a recommendation. But so often when it's writing, someone else can do it for a student. Do you worry about – well, and we just have had this terrible college scandal. Do you worry about that?
I do worry about it sometimes. I think that most students are honest. I think that students who – allow someone else to interfere too much in the work that they're doing, do themselves a disservice, and I don't think they're likely to get a better result than if they just did the work themselves.
Yeah. All right. Well, so what are some other supplemental questions, these short, you know, snapshot questions?
You know, the best one I've ever seen, and one that we used a number of years ago that a colleague came up with was, look out any window in your home. What would you change about what you see? Hmm. And, you know, I like prompts that direct students outwards. I don't think it's a healthy or helpful thing to encourage students to write about themselves or to make them feel that they have to write about themselves in order to have a chance to put their best self forward.
That's so interesting. I'm looking at a question that someone asked. There is a Quaker saying, let your life speak, describe the environment you were raised in, you know, your family, and how it influenced the person you are today. And I was thinking, if there's a young person, you know, let's say both parents are struggling alcoholics, that definitely shaped that child, but they may not feel free to talk about it.
You know, I think you're making a great point. Students should not feel compelled to tell us something that they wouldn't tell someone else. You know, it's easy for students sometimes to feel that they're trapped into talking about the best thing that ever happened to them or the worst thing that ever happened to them, something profound that scarred them or that helped them become the person they are. It's really hard for any writer to talk about such things, and it's especially hard for an 18-year-old writer to talk about such things in 250 words.
Yeah. What's your advice to students handling these supplemental, these shorter questions that schools are asking?
Well, the first thing, again, is to write about something outside the self, mm-hmm. or at least not feel compelled to write about something that's intimate. And the second suggestion is to write about something small. You know, you said a supplemental response is more like the Twitter of college admissions. It's more like a caption to a picture rather than a full-blown essay. So writing about something to scale. Students need to sound like the good people they are instead of the people they think we want them to be. And one of the things that makes me sad about reading college essays is when students are trying to throw the voice of an adult or a teacher or worse yet an admissions officer to make them sound like a middle-aged person or to make them sound like someone who's had more education than they've had. That's not what we need to hear. We really just need to hear from a person, and preferably from the wonderful 18-year-old person who's writing the vignette, not from anyone else.
Write in your own voice, correct?
Let us hear you. Let us hear your voice.
Stephen Farmer, Vice Provost for Enrollment and Undergraduate Admissions at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, on these supplemental questions college applicants will be finding. Stephen, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Well, now let's go to upstate New York for a look at how the logging industry is evolving. Many of the axes are gone, replaced by huge machines and complicated technical know-how. And one college is using the Adirondacks as an outdoor classroom to train young people to become the next generation of loggers. North Country Public Radio's Fernando Naro reports.
It didn't take long after arriving at Paul Smith's college to know that the action would not happen in a classroom.
So you'll see two modern types of logging going on. One involves hand crews using chainsaws. The other involves a feller buncher, which is a machine that cuts the trees and then groups them together for a grapple skidder to pick up.
Brett McLeod is the chair of the college's forestry department. He hands me a hard hat and explains what I'll see in the woods. McLeod looks like a lumberjack, but he speaks like an academic. He drives me into the woods in a big red pickup truck. McLeod says the average age of loggers in New York is almost 60, and the industry needs replacements. That's why Paul Smith started the program, now in its third year. The students come to the Adirondacks for a month, and when they're done, they receive a New York Logger Training Certificate. They call this place the Landing. It's here where all the wood is collected. The students drive skidders, big machines that drag piles of logs. Instructors mark the spots where all the timber should be placed. Instructor Paul Pillis stands by a big stack of logs and tests student Fabian Shattuck.
Now this particular buyer, what's the length that they prefer?
16'6".
16'6", very good. So I'm going to hold the end of the tape for you, and you go up there, up the left side of the tree, and when you get, look at your tape, judge 16'6". Visually mark your length and let's cut that off.
Shattuck takes out his measuring tape and starts pacing carefully along the mound of logs.
Okay, you're right about there. Mark your 16'6".
He crouches down to mark the precise spot where he's about to make a cut. From a distance, Pillis judges his technique.
what I'm watching in my head is he's starting the chainsaw right now, is to watch that he doesn't pinch the saw. So he's got to watch out for what we call the compression wood compared to the tension wood. There, he did a good job right there. So we're going to cut another tree right next to it.
It's this kind of hands-on learning, combined with the opportunity to operate heavy machinery, that convinced Shattuck to enroll. He hopes he can turn what he learned here into a career with his cousin's logging business in Vermont. Alexander Babson also wants a new career. He's 27 years old and for the past 4 years worked in a car dealership as a mechanic. But he kept going back to the time in high school when he took a forestry class.
And I've always missed being out in the woods and logging and working with the heavy equipment and stuff. You know, I thought it was a great opportunity to go try it and learn something that I like to do and hopefully make a good career out of it.
At first, Babson was excited but nervous. He says he received mixed reactions when he told friends and co-workers about where he was going next.
People at my automotive job, they were like, "You're gonna go do what?" They were very shocked and surprised. But people that know me, they really thought that this was an amazing thing for me. They really thought that automotive wasn't a good fit and that forestry was just something that I have a knack for.
Babson is attracted to the wages. Entry-level loggers make between $16 and $20 per hour on average. He says once he gets his certificate, he has a job lined up with Finch Paper in Glens Falls, New York, and he hopes to build a long career in logging, one tree at a time. For Here and Now, I'm Fernando Narro.
Just minutes from now, Apple will kick off its biggest media event of the year in Cupertino, California, and is expected to unveil new iPhone designs. CEO Tim Cook will take the stage in a bit, but we've got a preview now with Ina Fried, chief technology correspondent for Axios, who's outside the event. Hi, Ina.
Hey, Jeremy.
Okay, so first of all, just what are you expecting at this event today?
You know, I think we'll certainly see the next crop of iPhones. We'll probably also see the Apple Watch's next design, as well as there's a strong rumors that we'll see something that looks like the Tile, or at least behaves like it, which is a device for tracking physical objects like your wallet or keys.
Explain, what would that do?
Certainly, I'll speak for myself. I lose things all the time, whether it's my keys, the remote control, or whatever. And so the idea of being able to track those using your phone is super attractive. Until now, the problem has really been the Tile, which is the best Bluetooth tracker on the market. It's still kind of bulky. It's hard to stick on something like a remote control or whatever. So if Apple's managed to slim the size and make it easier to find these in a small indoor place, that could be really useful.
There's a lot of talk about big changes to the cameras on the new iPhones. What are you hearing?
This is one of the most important areas for phones these days. We use them more as cameras than talking on the phone. And it's also one of the areas that gets better every year. So you don't always have a flashy new design. And by all accounts, they don't have a radically different design. But the camera is something you can always do. So the rumors are that they're adding one more lens to both the replacement for the XS as well as the replacement from the XR. So the XS would get a third camera and the XR would get a second camera.
And why do you need three cameras on one phone?
Well, obviously, you're only taking one picture, but you want that to be the best picture. So a lot of the other premium phones on the market, in addition to a small zoom lens that kind of brings you twice as close, have added an ultra-wide lens for either taking good group photos or really nice landscapes when you're in the middle of nature or what have you.
What about other than the phone and the Tile? Are you expecting anything else from Apple today?
I think, you know, in addition to the phone, the Tile-like tracker and the watch, I think we might hear more on services. And this is really Apple's big push, is to take that giant base of iPhone users and sell them more stuff. And it needs to do that because the smartphone market isn't growing like it once did. So services are a way for Apple to further lock in its customers and also sell more stuff to them.
And services like what? Are we talking about iTunes?
So the ones that they've announced so far are a paid TV service, Apple TV Plus, and then something called Apple Arcade, which is a paid subscription game service that's supposed to debut later this year. So we might get pricing and more details on that today.
Now, Apple iPhones, as you mentioned, the growth is not what it used to be. What has that done to the company?
So far, I mean, Apple's still printing money. It's not a big short-term concern. They make a ton of money, and people are still buying iPhones. At the same time, you know, investors always want growth, and it's hard to grow when your core market isn't growing. And this is, you know, a giant market. It's not like they could go into something else and have a business the same size as the iPhone.
Some people had been expecting Apple to make an announcement about phones that connect to 5G this year. Is that likely to happen?
That won't happen. I will stake my reputation that Apple will not have a 5G phone. The networks just aren't there, and Apple is not the first to adopt a new network technology. They were slower to bring 3G to the early iPhones. They were slower to bring 4G. They tend to wait till the technology is a little more mature, till there are fewer trade-offs in terms of battery life and other things.
Ina, we just did an interview with an author, Mike Isaac, who wrote about the rise of Uber. And I remember one of the most interesting things was how important Apple is to Uber and Uber's ability to get into the App Store. What are the other companies in Silicon Valley thinking as they watch this today? Is this an important event for other companies that may have apps on Apple's App Store?
It's very important. I mean, even small changes that Apple makes can make a big deal. A good example of this is one of the features in the new version of iOS that'll be on new phones, but also coming to your older phones, is the ability to be more specific on when you want location used. And so Apple will let you turn off location when the app is not in use. It'll let you give it one-time permission to use your location. And these kinds of things are really big deal. Facebook likes to know where you are at any given time. It feels like the information it has is more valuable when it can track your location. So even small changes like this are the kinds of things that everyone, big and small in the app market, is going to be paying a lot of attention to.
Does Apple ever, at these events, talk about some of the negative stories about them? That there was one that just came out the other day. The group China Labor Watch said yesterday that Apple and its manufacturing partner Foxconn violated Chinese labor laws by using too many temporary staff in the world's largest iPhone factory.
They really don't. I mean, they use this as a chance to give their best sales pitch. And that's what I would expect today. I wouldn't expect to hear them talk about, you know, anything labor related, especially since they like to give the impression that these iPhones just magically emanate from Cupertino. They don't even like to talk about the fact that they're made in China or made by a third party contractor.
That is Ina Fried, chief technology correspondent for Axios, outside the Apple event in Cupertino, which is about to start. Ina, thank you.
Thanks so much, Jeremy.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service, but made in America. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.